Remember last time that I explained the difference between protein coding genes and non-protein coding genes? I did that for you guys, didn't I? Did I talk about this? Well, let me quickly say it then. A gene in general is just a subsequence of DNA in the overall very long sequence that we call a chromosome. But what a gene is a set of instructions. The sequence is a set of instructions for how to build an RNA molecule. It's in all cases of genes. Now, the vast majority of genes are so-called protein-coding genes, because they are indirectly instructions for how to build proteins, but they are directly, protein-coding genes, are directly instructions for how to build messenger RNA. Messenger, and that's called transcription. Whenever a gene gets transcribed, it produces RNA. For a protein-coding gene, when it gets transcribed, it creates messenger RNA. And messenger RNA now is carrying a code that it learned from DNA. DNA's job is done in that case. And messenger RNA now has a code that serves as an instruction for how to build a polypeptide. This is why these are called protein coding genes. All right? And that's most genes. But that's not all genes. And this is why I was saying last time that even the modified second modification of the hypothesis, when they started calling it the one gene, one polypeptide hypothesis, is still wrong, because not all genes even code for polypeptides. The ones that don't are called non-protein coding genes. They also get transcribed, and just like all transcription of all genes creates RNA, for non-protein coding genes, the RNA that gets produced is not messenger RNA, it's any of the other various kinds of RNA that exist. So there's all kinds of different RNAs, and we'll talk about some of them in here. No cell has any idea how to build any RNA molecule on its own. It has to be told how to. That's why you need a gene to tell it how to build an RNA. All right? So the protein-coding genes specifically tell the cell how to build messenger RNA, which can then go on and tell the cell how to build a polypeptide. You end up with a protein. The non-protein-coding genes are there simply to tell the cell how to build the other kinds of RNA that cells need. Well, from here on out, we're going to be talking about gene expression, starting in slide 2 where we are. And I just want you to know that usually when we say gene, without bothering to say protein coding gene, that's really what we mean. So unless I specifically say non-protein coding gene from here on out, when I just say gene, I'm talking about protein coding genes, including when I say gene expression. So the process of gene expression is really two parts that happen always in this order. First is transcription. When that's done, then translation occurs. And even though we call this overall process gene expression, transcription, which is just half of gene expression, is the only part of gene expression that the genes are directly involved in. The genes are DNA sequences. All right, so each gene is DNA. But the only part of gene expression that a gene is directly involved in is the first part, which is transcription. Transcription reads the code that's in the gene and creates a messenger RNA based on that code. So messenger RNA is the direct product of transcription. And that's where DNA's job is done in the overall process. The mRNA that's created as a product of transcription is called the mRNA transcript. That transcript is now a code in itself. DNA's job is done. Its code was used to build the mRNA. Now the mRNA has a code, and that instructs the cell how to build the polypeptide. Well, that building of the polypeptide by reading the messenger RNA code, which tells the cell how to assemble the polypeptide, in other words, how many amino acids to use and which kind of amino acid to be put in each place as you string them together, that's what translation is, the actual building of the polypeptide. DNA is not involved in that directly. It's only involved in creating the code in the form of the messenger RNA that is then used to assemble the polypeptide. That's true for all cells. All cells need gene expression for the same reason. And this notice is why what I've said since the beginning of the term is true. Genes don't directly give organisms their traits, only indirectly. What directly give organisms their traits are the specific proteins, polypeptides, that the cells in that organism are able to create. Well, there's no limit to the number of possible proteins that can be built, but your body is only ever going to be able to build the ones that it has instructions for, which are your genes, unless you're artificially genetically modified. If a new gene is put into your cells, then they would suddenly be able to make a new kind of protein. All right? Every cell needs proteins, therefore every cell has to undergo gene expression. But we see two versions here, or we see two examples shown here, corresponding to the dichotomy of cell types. So there's gene expression in a prokaryote on the top. A bacterium is a typical prokaryote, and a eukaryotic cell on the bottom. It's very similar in both, but of course there is a fundamental difference between a prokaryotic cell and a eukaryotic cell structurally, like we've been talking about. Namely, that a prokaryotic cell is not compartmentalized since it doesn't have any membrane-bounded organelles, including a nucleus. So the interior of the cell is all one compartment. And therefore, all of gene expression, both parts, transcription and translation, occur in the same place, the same compartment, for a prokaryotic cell since it's the only compartment it has. That's the cytoplasm. The transcription part of gene expression in all cases has to happen where the DNA is, because the DNA is directly involved in transcription. The gene gets read in transcription. Well, in a prokaryotic cell, the DNA is in the only compartment, the cytoplasm. So that's where transcription occurs. Translation occurs, and remember, translation is the assembly of the polypeptide, that occurs where the little molecular machines, the ribosomes that we talked about when we toured the cell and looked at all the organelles, little molecular machines that assemble these polypeptides are out in the cytoplasm. Well, it's not out in the cytoplasm in a bacteria, in a prokaryote, it's just it's the same compartment, the cytoplasm. So translation occurs where transcription has already occurred for a prokaryote. But in a eukaryotic cell, there's two different compartments where these two different parts of gene expression occur. As always, transcription has to happen where the DNA is, but for a eukaryotic cell, that's the nucleus. And so mRNA gets created in a eukaryotic cell in the nucleus. That's where the DNA is. And the extra complication that eukaryotic cells have for gene expression is that the ribosomes are out in the cytoplasm, and so that's where translation occurs, which means for that to happen, after the mRNA gets created in transcription, it needs to get to the other compartment. So it has to exit the nucleus, which is why the nuclear envelope is perforated with all of those nuclear pores that we talked about earlier. That's a way for messenger RNA to get out of the nucleus into the cytoplasm and meet up with ribosomes these little brown things, to actually assemble the polypeptides. So that's one major difference. Another, though, between the two cell types is that for a prokaryotic cell, the messenger RNA, which is the red ribbon here in this cartoon, that gets created in transcription is already complete and ready to go as to do its job in translation. In other words, what comes directly off of the transcription assembly line in a prokaryotic cell does not need to be modified before it gets used in translation. But that's not true for eukaryotic cells, which is why we have a red ribbon coming off the transcription assembly line in the eukaryotic cell example, but it's labeled as pre-mRNA because even though transcription is done, that transcript needs to be modified in a couple ways that we'll talk about later before it can actually be used in translation. So those modifications, since they happen after transcription, are called post-transcriptional modifications. And that's a further complication of eukaryotic cells that prokaryotic cells don't have. Now to three. The top box here shows just a tiny, tiny piece of the overall very long length of a chromosome. A chromosome is millions of nucleotides long. Well, a chromosome is really more than DNA, like we talked about, right? It's DNA and proteins. But I'm talking about the DNA of a chromosome is all one very long double-stranded DNA. Millions of nucleotides long and containing thousands of genes. But each gene is structurally no different from all the rest of the DNA sequence. It's all just A's, C's, T's, and G's from one end to the other, millions. And a gene is just some subset of that overall length, that overall sequence. So it's not something that you would look under a scope and say, okay, there's a gene, this part is not a gene, it's all A's, T's, C's, and G's. But I don't remember whether I mentioned this, it's only less than 1% of the overall nucleotides in your DNA that are in your genes. Most of your DNA is so-called non-coding sequences that are between genes, represented here by the light blue. And by the way, the dark blue, light blue thing that we've been using now, I don't know why they ever used the colors, but that is not what this means anymore. This is just simply different colors. And this is not drawn to scale, so really these non-coding sequences between genes are very long. That's why they make up most of your DNA. But anyway, you see three of however many genes here, one, two, and three. And the little box shows you what we're looking close up at. So this is not, this double-stranded blue DNA here with the C's, T's, A's, and G's is not even an entire gene. It's just one small piece of a gene, of one gene. But it's a double-stranded DNA, like you're accustomed to knowing about DNA. Think about the other process. We're about to look at transcription, which is one of DNA's functions, but we've already covered DNA's other function, right, in the previous chapter, which is DNA replication. Remember that they both, I said that they both, doing either one of those two functions requires separating the strands, which is why it's important to have them only lightly held together, which is why hydrogen bonds are important. But when you think about what we just covered in the previous chapter, DNA replication, when we separated the two strands, we used each one of them separately, right? Each one of them was read so that you could make a complementary copy of each one to end up with two double strands. But that's not the case for transcription. We have two strands, yes, because it's DNA. But when a gene gets transcribed, only one of the two DNA strands is actually read after the two are separated from each other. The other one is just held temporarily out of the way and ignored. And the reason this makes sense, by the way, is because DNA is a double-stranded molecule. RNA is a single-stranded molecule. So we're not trying to make new DNA. Therefore, we only need one strand's worth of information to code for a single-stranded RNA. Now, the top of the two blue strands here, just in this example, is labeled the template strand. The other one is the non-template strand. Any given gene has a template strand and a non-template strand. The template strand is the strand that actually gets read by the cell. And the non-template strand gets ignored. But it just happens to be the top one in this figure. Which of the two strands it is just depends. It's on a gene-by-gene basis. So gene 2, if you go down the line and hit gene 2, yes, it might be the top one in that one as well, or it could be the bottom one. But in any given gene, it's just one of the two strands that it actually gets read. That's the template strand. Now, somewhat confusingly, though, because of complementarity, the template strand is the strand of DNA that gets read. But when you build something out of RNA that's otherwise complementary to this, that means the RNA that you produce is going to end up looking just like the one that you didn't read, except it's going to have U's instead of T's. You following me what I'm saying here? So the messenger RNA that gets created is just like the non-template strand, except it'll have U's instead of T's. Okay, now, all of gene expression is summarized here. You have transcription first and then translation. And obviously, both of those names start with trans, which means that they are easily confused by people. And the best way of approaching this to not stay confused is to think about what the words mean. They were chosen to describe these processes for good reasons, for good linguistic reasons. So, transcription means to rewrite. And that's actually what you're doing by taking notes. You are transcribing what I say. And if you order a transcript of a television program, for instance, you'll get a written account of what was said in the program. Okay, so that's what transcribe means. And notice, when you are transcribing me, you are rewriting in the same language. I'm delivering this lecture in English, you're writing in English. Well, that describes what happens in transcription in a cell, because you're starting with a code that is kind of like a language. The DNA, the gene, is written in the language of nucleotides. And to transcribe it simply means to rewrite it. You create a messenger RNA, which is also written in the language of nucleotides. In a sense, it's kind of a different dialect because you're going from DNA to RNA, but it's still nucleotides. And in this sense, this is why genes are analogous to books. And the entire genome, which is all of your DNA, the entire cell's worth, all of your chromosomes combined, is like a library. Except it's not a lending library, meaning you're not allowed to take the books home. Some of the books in a library are on reserve only, right? Meaning you can look at them while you're there, use them, but you can't take them with you. That's what a gene is like. And specifically, it's like a non-circulating or non-lending instruction manual. So you can go to the library, while you're there, look at that instruction manual, and the instruction manual is how to build an RNA. All right? It's how to build a protein, would be like what the manual is. But you're not allowed to take that book home with you. So if you're going to have any success in building the protein, since you can't remember it, just memorize it, you're going to write it down while you're there, right? And then you can give them back the manual. And now you have that information. Well, when you rewrite that, that's what a messenger RNA is like. Then you can leave the library because you have your own copy of the instructions for how to actually build the protein. But there's no language change. That's why it's called transcription. It just means rewriting. The word translation, on the other hand, says that there is a language change. And that's why someone coined this phrase for this process. Because you're starting out for translation with a code that's in the language of nucleotides, messenger RNA, and you're going to then rewrite that in the language of amino acids to build a polypeptide. That's a change in language. So hopefully you can remember it that way. Transcription always happens first, and then translation. Now, another really important point of this slide is that DNA and RNA are not only both nucleic acids, meaning they're both made out of nucleotides, but as we've already discussed, both DNA and RNA use four types of nucleotides, right? There's four different nitrogenous bases that are used in DNA. There are four different nitrogenous bases that are used in RNA. Now, they're not the same four, but it's four in both cases. And since it's four in both cases, transcription features a one-to-one correspondence, meaning that a single nucleotide in DNA, in the gene, corresponds to a single nucleotide in the mRNA transcript that's produced, simply by the rules of complementarity, right? A single A would, in DNA, call for a T, but there's no T used in mRNA, so it's a U instead. A C calls for a G calls for a C, a T calls for an A. That's a one-to-one correspondence. That's nice and simple. Simplest possibility. And it would be nice if you could also have a one-to-one correspondence in translation. What I mean is that it would be nice if one RNA nucleotide in messenger RNA could correspond to or signify one amino acid. But it's not that way, and it can't be. What's the problem? Why can't it be?
Well, then we'd have like a bunch of repeated proteins and all that
everywhere. Yes, in a sense, but not only that. It's simply that we wouldn't be able to make all the proteins that are necessary, right? If you tried designing this is not by design, it's by natural selection, but if you tried to design a one-to-one correspondence, you could do it, you could start the process, right? You could say, okay, U signifies phenylalanine, one of the amino acids, one of the biological amino acids. G signifies alanine, whatever. You can choose whatever ones you want. But you'd run out after four, right? Because you only have four nucleotides to work with. Four different ones, four types. Well, how many amino acids do you have to specify?
Like
20.
20.
Yeah, you have to specify 20 amino acids. So you can't have a one-to-one correspondence just for that reason. Okay, so you can't use the simplest possibility, which, if that were possible, that's what evolution would have favored, the simplest. Therefore, you're going to have to use more than one nucleotide. In other words, you're going to have to use a sequence of nucleotides in order to specify just one amino acid. Well, the next simplest possibility beyond one is to just use a sequence of two, right? A sequence of two nucleotides each position in which there are four possibilities, right? Therefore, there's how many overall possible two-digit sequences? Not eight. 16. You have four choices for the first, and for each of those four, you have four choices for the second. So it's four times four. Well, 16 is still fewer than 20. So even that wouldn't work, and that's why it didn't happen evolutionarily. So the next simplest possibility is to use a third one. A third nucleotide, a sequence of three, in other words. And so mathematically, how many three-digit sequences are there? No. There's four possibilities for the first. For each of those, there's four possibilities for the second. So that's four times four, 16, as we said. And for each of those 16, there's four possibilities for the third. So it's four times four times four, four cubed, which is 64. Well, 64 is way more than 20. So that's already enough. And if you did it with a sequence of four, it would be even more complicated unnecessarily, which is why it didn't happen via natural selection. Okay, so what actually evolved is the simplest possible way to do this, with not a one-to-one correspondence between mRNA nucleotide and amino acid, but a three-to-one. And that's why a triplet, a so-called triplet, which is three consecutive nucleotides, is labeled here with the word codon. A codon is three mRNA nucleotides that together, kind of like a word, specify a single amino acid. TRP here is just one of the 20 biological amino acids, tryptophan and then phenylalanine, glycine, and so on. All right? Now, codon is used kind of loosely. Technically, the word codon should be used only to describe a triplet in the messenger RNA, the red. But sometimes we use the word codon to also describe the corresponding triplet in the DNA that it was created from in transcription. Okay, so that's, you know, I hear people say this all the time, but codon really is referring to the RNA. And codons shouldn't have T's in them because RNA doesn't have thymine. All right, now let's go to 4. And speaking of 64, what we have here is an exhaustive listing of all 64 possible codons. This is the genetic code. It is the genetic code, the universal genetic code. This is not the genetic code of some specific species. This is the genetic code for all organisms. And that universality of the genetic code is one major bit of evidence that supports the fact that we are, all organisms are descended from the original lineage of successful cells over 4 billion years ago. That's the trunk of the overall tree of life that I'm talking about. That's, everyone uses it because we all descended from the same ones. So this is the genetic code, and there are all 64 possibilities here, most of which are lavender color here, or bluish, whatever that is, but not all. 60 of them are this bluish color, but notice that we have three of them that are orange. Well, before I get to that, let me just say on the normal blue ones, the codons themselves are all caps. That's mRNA, a triplet of mRNA. UUGs, for instance. Anything all in caps, that's RNA. The three-digit symbols that are next to the right of each bracket that are not all caps, those are just abbreviations for the biological amino acids. So leucine, valine, and so on. isoleucine. Those are amino acids, not RNA. But what you see is that these three orange ones are labeled stop. And they all function identically, so it doesn't matter which one of these is used. But these are special codons that do not specify any amino acid. They function as so-called stop codons. And so you find one of these three, and it doesn't matter which one, but only one of them, at the end of a messenger RNA. Technically, it's not the very end of the molecule, but when the ribosome, which we'll see, reads the mRNA one codon at a time, like reading a sentence one word at a time, when it encounters any one of these three stop codons, that tells the ribosome, you've already put on the final amino acid for this polypeptide. It's done. Time to stop translation. Okay? The green one, there's only one of those, AUG, is a special one because it's the only one that does double duty. Now, notice it says met. That's methionine, which is one of the 20 amino acids. So every time AUG comes up and is read by the ribosome, it's going to tell the ribosome, okay, now it's time to put a methionine on to the polypeptide. So it always specifies methionine. But it also has the secondary job of serving as the start codon. And so that means when the ribosome starts reading, what it's doing is really looking for the first AUG it finds. And that will say, okay, this is the first word. This is where we start counting triplets or codons. But since it also specifies methionine, that means that every polypeptide that gets built in translation starts out with methionine as the first amino acid, whether it's supposed to be there or not. And sometimes it's really not supposed to be there, so after it gets built, the cell has to remove that methionine. That would be an example of post-translational modification of the polypeptide. Now, I need to tell you two important aspects of this universal genetic code. One is that the genetic code is redundant. And the other is that it is not ambiguous. So it's important to understand what each of those words refer to. Just in everyday language, what does it mean to be redundant?
Repetitive,
right. You say this, basically the same thing in different ways, if you're redundant. Or in aviation, for instance, there's redundancy built into the aircraft. You have two engines so that if one fails, you still live. But that's right, it's repetitive. And I said that the genetic code is redundant. The reason it's redundant is that 64 is greater than 20. You have to use 3 because 16 isn't enough, right? You have to use 3, which gives you 64 possibilities, but that's way more than you actually need because you only need to specify 20 biological amino acids. So you have a bunch left over, and you therefore can use more than one different codon to specify the same amino acid. In the genetic code that's listed here, you see this in the form of these brackets, where, like, for instance, CUU, CUC, CUA, CUG, all four of those, and in fact UUA and UUG as well, so six different codons, all mean the same thing. They all tell the ribosome leucine is the amino acid to put down next. So linguistically, this is really exactly analogous to synonyms. And English has more synonyms than any other language. It has more words than any other language because it's really just a mishmash of a bunch of languages that were combined. And that's why we have so many ways, for instance, to say big. You can say big, But there's a lot of other words you can use that also mean big. And similarly, because 64 is more than 20, you can have more than one codon specify the same amino acid. And by the way, it doesn't matter which one you use at all. CUU means exactly the same thing as UUG. It doesn't matter which one's there. You're going to make the same protein, or you're going to have the same amino acid in that position. Okay, now the second important thing is that I said it, the genetic code is not ambiguous. It is redundant, but it's not ambiguous. So consider what that means in everyday language. What does it mean to be ambiguous? Ambiguity is a certain type of unclarity, vagueness. Ambiguity is vague, unclear, because there are multiple possible meanings, and you might not know what the proper meaning is. Now, there's thousands of examples of ambiguity in language, but I usually use the same example. It's a simple two-word sentence. I'm hot. That's an ambiguous statement, because if I say that, it could mean that my body temperature is elevated. That's one meaning of hot, right? It could mean that I am a currently very popular celebrity. It could mean that I'm very angry at the moment. It could mean that I'm sexually attractive. And there might be other meanings that you can think of for I'm hot, but certainly there's at least those four. And those are really different meanings, right? So that if that's all I say, you can't get it from context, you have no idea which of those I mean. That's ambiguity. It's not such a big deal in language because usually you can, because of other things that are said, you can tell what the meaning is. But ambiguity would be a huge problem in the genetic code. It's not ambiguous, but if the genetic code were ambiguous, what that would mean is that a codon would specify a certain amino acid sometimes, but it would specify a totally different amino acid other times. And that means when assembling the polypeptide, you wouldn't always get the same protein. You would get a different primary structure, which is the sequence of amino acids like we talked about. That's such a big deal because that primary structure, the sequence of amino acids, determines how it folds up. Secondary and tertiary structure depend on primary structure. And shape is everything for a protein. No matter what its specific function is, the protein has that function, is able to do that thing because of its shape. So you want to make sure you have the sequence specified unambiguously. And it is. That's indicated by the fact that every single one of these non-stop codons specifies just one amino acid. Okay. Let's go on to five now. Look at two pictures that depict organisms that are kind of unusual. Because tobacco plants don't usually glow, and neither do pigs usually. But these are not photoshopped photos. These organisms actually are glowing. And that's because each one has been genetically modified. The modification occurs to just one cell when they were just one cell big. You insert a gene from some other organism, and if everything goes right, it's now incorporated into the genome of that cell. And then you let it divide like cells do, and it's going to make copies. So that new gene is going to be in both of those cells, and then all four cells next, and so it'll be in all cells of the whole body when it grows up. So the tobacco plant got a gene from a firefly, which naturally glows, and the pig got a similar gene from a jellyfish, a species that naturally glows. And that's why they are glowing. But the question here is, Since tobacco plants and pigs don't normally have these genes, how is it that they are able to glow? In other words, how is it that they are able to understand these genes when they came from a totally different organism? They end up making the same protein. The protein is what makes them be able to glow. But how are they able to make the same protein? How are they able to understand a firefly gene or a jellyfish gene? I already gave you the answer today. Right. It's because of the universality of the genetic code. It's the genetic code. It's not a pig's genetic code. So genes from other organisms will be understood by recipient organisms, organisms that receive that gene, the genetic modification. Now to six, and we can start talking about how this gene expression happens at the molecular level. So naturally enough, we're starting with the first part of gene expression, which is transcription. And you can see here with the blue numbers that transcription as a process occurs in three subphases, which are initiation, elongation, and termination. Pretty descriptive words. Initiation is another name for start. Elongation refers to the fact that nucleotides are added one by one to make the messenger RNA. And then termination is just another name for stopping the process. The blue double-stranded DNA that's at the top, once again, dark blue and light blue do not mean old and new material anymore. Here, the dark blue is just the part of the DNA sequence that this gene is. Okay, so it's labeled as a transcription unit, but think of it as a gene. That's what it is. And the kind of seafoam green region that's labeled as the promoter, that is the beginning of the gene. It's a sequence of DNA just like the whole thing is, but there's a special sequence at the beginning of a gene, sequence of nucleotides, DNA nucleotides, that allows the cell to tell that's where the gene starts, and that's called the promoter. Now this egg-shaped thing in this cartoon, grayish or whitish, notice is labeled RNA polymerase. So you know that's an enzyme. And you've already learned about other polymerases, right? DNA polymerase 3 and DNA polymerase 1 were used in DNA replication. They're both, RNA polymerase and DNA polymerases get their name for the same reason. They both polymerize. In other words, they both help create a polymer. In this case, the polymers are polynucleotides. But DNA polymerase polymerizes a DNA polynucleotide. Right? Now we're going to build RNA instead. So it's RNA polymerase that does this job. And as I've already said, doing this job of transcription, just like doing the job of DNA replication, requires reading the codes, which itself requires separating the strands. And so this can't happen unless initiation happens, which is RNA polymerase being able to recognize and bind to the promoter region of the gene. So it not only recognizes it, it actually binds to the double helix there. And only then can it separate the two strands from each other. But that's initiation. And notice nothing is built yet. It's simply recognizing the beginning of the gene and separating the two strands. Elongation is when the actual nucleotides get added one by one. So I want you to compare this to the elongation of a new strand of DNA in the previous process from the previous chapter. DNA replication also requires adding nucleotides one at a time to make a strand, right? But the goal in DNA replication is to make a strand of DNA. And that had a complication, right? Because you can't start adding DNA nucleotides. You have to only add them to something that's already built, which is why you needed an RNA primer, the little red pieces, which is really not what you want to be there. You want it to be DNA, but it has to be an RNA to start, and then you can add to that. That's why you have the complication of having to go back later with DNA polymerase 1 and take those RNAs out. Well, that's not a problem in transcription, because the goal for transcription is not to build a DNA strand. It's to build an RNA strand. And so you don't have to mess around with any primers. You can just start with what you want, RNA nucleotides, one at a time. But it's similar to DNA replication in that the specific RNA nucleotides that are chosen for each position depend on complementarity with the DNA, specifically the template strand of the DNA. Remember, the non-template strand is just being ignored. It's moved out of the way temporarily. So, whatever the DNA nucleotide is, the complementary one is going to be laid down as RNA, and it'll get longer and longer as the RNA polymerase moves along the length of the gene. By the way, when it's done with a certain stretch, as this will move to the right in the elongation picture, what's behind it has already been used. The DNA has already been used there. And so it will just naturally go back together because the DNA hasn't been changed. The two strands are still complementary to each other. So they'll just form hydrogen bonds again. It'll seal up on its own. Now, termination is the end of this. And when RNA polymerase gets to the end of the gene, it will detach from the DNA. You see the egg falling off here. And it will also detach from the RNA transcript, which was attached to it as it got longer along the way. So now you have a completed RNA transcript, as it's shown here. And what I was referring to earlier when we compared prokaryotic and eukaryotic cells is that if this is a prokaryotic cell, this completed RNA transcript is literally completed, meaning it's not going to be modified. It's ready to go for translation. But if this is a eukaryotic cell, this is the completed transcript, meaning that transcription is done, but the transcript itself needs to be modified before it can be used in translation. And that is what I was talking about when I said there in a eukaryotic cell there needs to be post-transcriptional modification of the transcript. Okay, now to 7. I mentioned in the previous slide that initiation requires not only the recognition of the promoter by the RNA polymerase, but also the binding of that polymerase to the promoter. So we can see the promoter region here. And in eukaryotic genes, the promoter includes the so-called TATA box, because there's a lot of T's and A's that are repeated. But anyway, what we see here is that in eukaryotes, it's not as simple as I was saying, meaning, yes, the RNA polymerase does need to bind to the promoter, but it usually cannot do that on its own, even though it might recognize the promoter. Instead, in eukaryotes, for the RNA polymerase enzyme to bind to the promoter, there have to already be special proteins that have bound to the promoter first. And those special proteins are called transcription factors. Remember in the cell cycle chapter, I said that we often use the word factor for a specific kind of protein in a cell. Well, this is another example of that terminology. Transcription factors are proteins that can bind to the promoter, and usually there are multiple different transcription factors that have to bind there individually first before before the RNA polymerase is able to then come and bind. And only if all of those are present will transcription happen. which means this gene, whatever it is going to remain turned off and not be expressed until all of the transcription factors are present so that the polymerase can get in there. Now, this seems like an unnecessary complication, but it helps cells to turn genes on only when it's appropriate to do that. Think about your body. All of your cells, except your red blood cells that don't have nuclei anymore because they've lost them, but all of your normal cells have each has a nucleus, and each nucleus has a full library. All of your genes are in every one of your nuclei. So your liver cells have the ability, because of the DNA, to produce fingernail structures, right? For instance. But it wouldn't want to do that, right? It could happen abnormally, by the way. Or, like, an ovary can start growing hair because it has the instructions. But in any given cell, only some of the genes need to be turned on. Only some of them need to be expressed. The rest of them are like shelving those books and really never showing them to anyone. So transcription factors allow a cell, in a eukaryotic cell, to make sure, yeah, the conditions are right to turn this gene on. And also, by the way, these transcription factors, think about this, they are themselves proteins, right? The whole end goal of this process is to build a protein. Well, these transcription factors are the end product of some other gene's transcription and translation. Right? So you have some genes that, when they get expressed through transcription and translation, produce proteins that then serve as transcription factors to help turn on other genes. So it's a complex system, but it allows for pretty exquisite control. Oh, by the way, just terminologically, if you have everything in place, then the entire complex, the RNA polymerase plus all of the transcription factors along with the promoter make up what's called the transcription initiation complex. It's not going to be initiation until all of that is in place. All right, now we're at 8. And what we're looking at here applies only to eukaryotic cells. Remember, I said that those are the ones that undergo post-transcriptional modification of their mRNA. So what comes directly off of the transcription assembly line in a eukaryotic cell is not yet ready to be used. One reason that the mRNA that comes right off of the transcription assembly line is not able to be used immediately in a eukaryote is that it can't get out of the nucleus, even though there are those nuclear pores. Allowing it to be strung through those nuclear pores requires sticking something on to the mRNA that's produced. And so that's part of eukaryotic post-transcriptional modification. The red stretch here is what transcription directly produces. That's the so-called pre-mRNA. The yellow ends are then added later. That's post-transcriptional modification. And notice the yellow ends are called the 5' cap. That's, of course, put onto the 5' end of the mRNA. And then you also have a so-called poly-A tail, which is just a bunch of adenine-based nucleotides stuck onto the other end. These yellow ends allow it to interact with the protein complexes that make up the nuclear pores so that it can get out of the nucleus and into the cytoplasm, where it can meet up with a ribosome and undergo translation to create a polypeptide. All right? That's only part, though, of post-transcriptional modification. It's an important part, but it's only part. Just to describe these other terms, though, notice that this overall stretch is more than what is going to be read by the ribosomes in translation. We talked about the genetic code and the fact that AUG serves as the start codon. So when you're reading this thing, which is a long sequence, you don't really start reading codons and call them codons until you reach that first AUG, which is the start codon. And then you read three nucleotides at a time as a single codon, one word at a time, like three-letter words, to keep adding amino acids until you reach any one of the three stop codons. So the UTRs here stands for untranslated regions. They're part of the transcript, but they're not going to be used to specify amino acids. They're not going to be translated into amino acid sequences. Untranslated region. So now in 9, we can see the other major part of post-transcriptional modification of eukaryotic mRNA. We've already added the yellow ends. That was the previous step. But now notice that this second modification actually shortens the transcript, because these pink regions, which are in the pre-mRNA at this point, are taken out. All right. So this brings up the distinction between these regions named exons and introns. And this applies to eukaryotic pre-mRNA. Exons get their names because it's short for expression. Exons are sequences within the pre-mRNA that are going to remain in, and therefore they will be translated. They'll be read by the ribosomes, which is what translation is. Introns, the int part of that word stands for intervening sequences, because they are, the introns are between the exons. And they're not going to be translated because they're going to be cut out or spliced out, which is exactly what this second part of post-transcriptional modification is. It's the splicing out of introns. To do that, of course, you have to make cuts. At every boundary between an exon and an intron, you have to make a cut. That'll allow you to take the introns out, but importantly, you can't just keep the cuts there, right? It would just be a bunch of pieces. So you not only have to recognize these boundaries, remove the introns, but then you have to sew the exons together end to end. And that's why you end up with one mature mRNA. Mature meaning it has now been post-transcriptionally modified and it's ready to be read in the process of translation by the ribosome, by a ribosome, to produce a polypeptide. In 10, we can see that this job of splicing out these introns and sewing together the exons is performed by a complex molecular machine called a spliceosome. Now, a spliceosome, this big circle here, is really a complex of other, also pretty complex, smaller pieces, which are some proteins, for one thing, but also some snRNPs, which are often pronounced as SNRPs. But snRNP stands for small nuclear ribonucleoproteins. Now, RNA, as you already know, stands for ribonucleic acid, right? A ribonucleic protein, RNP, is part nucleic acid, part RNA, in other words, and part protein. It's a complex. All right? So the red ribbon here, that's the RNA part of it. The bluish circle around it is the protein part of it, and together, it is an snRNP. SN, small nuclear, just simply means compared to other things, it's smaller and it's occurring in the nucleus. SNRNA, by the way, is the specific kind of RNA that's in an snRNP. And so this is just one of many different kinds of RNA. We've already mentioned two kinds, right? Messenger RNA is one kind of RNA. SNRNA is another kind. And we're not going to even bother with all of the kinds of RNA in this course, but they exist. We're still going to talk about others, though, a little bit later. Anyway, if you then take several of these SNRNPs and then complex them with still other proteins, the overall very complex molecular machine is the spliceosome. And the SNRNAs that are part of this spliceosome, in other words, the red ribbons in here, are what, via complementarity rules, allows the spliceosome to recognize the beginnings and ends of introns. You see that happening right here. So a spliceosome not only recognizes, okay, this is where an exon ends, this is where an intron begins, and then this is where the intron ends and the next exon begins, but it also makes those cuts. And once that intron gets removed, the two exons get hooked together end to end. So spliceosome literally means splicing body. Some means body. The cutout intron that you see here, the light pink, as far as translation is concerned, or gene expression, that's worthless. It's just trash, but it's only worthless for the purposes of translation. It's still a sequence of RNA nucleotides, and therefore it's valuable as raw materials. And so it'll get digested into RNA nucleotides and reused, but it's just not going to be used for translation. Okay, 11. So at the top here we have one gene, just part of an overall DNA. But notice that within the gene there are exons and introns, like we've just been talking about. And the introns, of course, get removed, so they don't specify anything. They're not used in translation. But each exon is going to specify a certain number of amino acids, because an exon is some number of codons long. Well, what you see by the color coding is that this first exon specifies this greenish part of the single polypeptide that's being built. Exon 2 is the gold version, the gold stretch, and then exon 3 is the purple stretch. They're all part of the one ribbon, the one polypeptide, right? It's a single sequence unbranching of amino acids, like all polypeptides are individually. But the color coding shows you that these bracketed different colors are called domains. In other words, a single polypeptide features multiple domains. The word domain, which has nothing to do with the taxonomic use of the word domain, like eukarya, bacteria, and archaea, that's totally different use of the word. A domain of a polypeptide is just part of the polypeptide. It's not the whole thing, as you can see in cartoon version here, but it's very similar to the idea of functional groups that we've already talked about, right? Functional groups are part, just not the entire molecule, but part of an organic molecule. A certain collection of atoms makes up a functional group, and the reason that we bother calling them functional groups is because that specific collection of atoms, like a carboxyl, gives the overall molecule certain functions. Well, similarly, a domain, which is only part of the overall polypeptide, is just a specific sequence of amino acids that's part of the overall sequence, but that particular domain features a part of the overall shape and therefore gives that polypeptide a certain function based on that part of the shape. Right? So they're very similar to functional groups. And they correspond to exons. The while I'm still there in 11, and a major reason for me mentioning all of this is that there's another aspect of eukaryotic gene expression that's different compared to prokaryotic cells. And this goes back to what I was saying last time about the one of the reasons why one gene, one polypeptide is incorrect. It's not completely correct. One reason it's incorrect is because not every gene is a protein-coding gene, so it's not going to correspond to a polypeptide. But another reason it's incorrect is that in a eukaryote, a single gene is actually able to specify more than one polypeptide. So it's not one gene, one polypeptide necessarily. And the reason for that is that under different circumstances, well, the mRNA gets produced the same way always. Whenever you transcribe that same gene, you're going to end up with the same pre-mRNA. But under different circumstances, the cell can change which exons it includes and which get treated as introns and get removed. So it's kind of under different circumstances, chemical circumstances, it's able to include or exclude some domains. And therefore you get an at least slightly different protein with a slightly different shape and therefore a slightly different function, even though it's all specified by the same gene. Okay? So that's a consequence of, or a benefit of, post-transcriptional modification of the mRNA in eukaryotes. This is also part of why we were so surprised in 2000 or whenever it was done, when we finally completed the Human Genome Project. One of the big questions that answered was, how many genes does a human have? And most biologists thought it was a lot more than we actually have. It ends up being roughly 20,000 is all. They thought it was much higher. But despite only having 20,000 genes, we're actually able to make more than 20,000 different kinds of proteins, because a single gene can be modified this way in terms of exons to create more than one polypeptide. Okay, now 12 is the beginning of the translation process. So we've finished transcription, the first part of gene expression, and this is kind of a natural break in topics, so I could leave it here, but let me just say something about 12 before we stop. Because this is kind of a summary slide of translation. What you see here is that the ribosome, which is the brown thing, is the organelle of translation. It's the little molecular machine that actually builds the polypeptide, however big it is, one amino acid at a time. But it's not able to do that on its own, of course. It has no idea how to build a polypeptide. It has to be told which specific amino acid to use in each position and for however many amino acids there are. So that those bits of information are given to the ribosome by the mRNA. The mRNA not only specifies how many amino acids long it's going to be, because some polypeptides are just dozens of amino acids long. Those are small polypeptides. Some are thousands. The ribosome has no idea, but the length of the messenger RNA tells it that. How many codons there are between start and stop tells the ribosome how many amino acids there are going to be in the polypeptide. But it also gives the important information of which specific one of the 20 occupies each position. And that's what codons are all about. That's what the genetic code tells the ribosome. We can see here that there are codons that are being read here. This one on the right with the brackets, the GGC is the next codon that's being read by this ribosome. Well, if you look up that codon in the genetic code I showed you earlier, it will specify glycine. And that's why glycine's being brought in next. But I'll stop it there and we'll talk about the particulars starting next time.